Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. No thanks. Yes, please. It just puts more drunk people on the road. I know the Puritans didn't enact this law, but it reminds me of them. Those are just some of the responses that we got when we asked listeners about whether they think Massachusetts should bring back happy hour. Hasn't existed here since 1984, but if it were up to the Massachusetts Senate, it would. And here to talk more about what it would mean for us, Philip Frateroli, a managing partner and CEO of Philmark Hospitality Group, which owns restaurants in Boston and Winchester, and Cheryl Strotter, owner of Soleil Restaurant and Catering in Roxbury. She's also a member of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. Philip, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Cheryl, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
So as we got ready to do this, we were really struck by how many of our listeners responded to the question about how they felt and how polarized they were. NBC 10 reporting from late last month showed about 70% of state residents want happy hour back. Philip, does it track with what you hear from people about this?
I mean, sure. I think everybody likes paying half price when they have the chance to do so. And but I think as restaurateurs and operators in Massachusetts, we have bigger concerns about what it means for our businesses and what it means for society in general to just get people loaded up and put them out in the street in the afternoon.
And that's really how we'll have this conversation today. We'll talk about the business side. We'll talk about the safety side. Cheryl Strotter, as I turn to you, I'm going to bring another listener voice in right now. Will D'Arcangelo of Fitchburg said, definitely not in favor of reinstating happy hour in Massachusetts. I remember the old days and how dangerous the roads could become. If it comes back, I will be altering the way and times I am on the road. So 70% in favor, but a voice like Will's there too. What have you heard, and do you remember a different time?
I do. I remember happy hour back in the 80s, and it was a way for people to socialize after work, connect with their friends. And as Philip said, there is a concern that is around safety. Even though 70% of the population would like to see that back, there's so many things that I'm sure were raised during our conversation that are important to the restaurant industry and folks like myself.
Okay, so this is kind of a funny question, Philip Frateroli, but we have people who could be almost 40 years old and not have experienced happy hour. So let's actually go back and define the term. What does a happy hour look like in a restaurant or bar? What do establishments offer?
So traditionally, it's something to the akin of like half-price drinks for an hour or two in the after work hours. But in Massachusetts, since the 80s, there's been a prohibition on drink specials that last for less than a week. So restaurants and bars have the ability to discount alcohol if we want to try to move something to get rid of something that's no longer in stock. But the special has to last for the week. And restaurants are being creative and have been creative in Massachusetts with, I've heard of appy hours with appetizers. I've even heard of yappy hours where people can bring their dogs to an after work setting.
Is it bad that I really like the idea of a yappy hour?
That's creativity. But what happy hour represents to us in the restaurant business is just a race to the bottom. It's a contest of who can discount their alcohol lower. And what does that serve? I mean, we're in the middle in the restaurant industry and in the country of a massive inflationary issue right now. I'm sure Cheryl and all restaurants out in the country are struggling right now with raising our prices on food and drinks because of the massive increases that we're getting from our distributors.
So that's Philip Frateroli. He's the managing partner with Philmark Hospitality Group. Let's turn now to Cheryl Strotter, owner of Soleil Restaurant and Catering in Roxbury. Cheryl, your reaction to what we just heard from Philip.
I totally understand and respect the position. For me, I would like to see it implemented in a way that is more responsible than it was back in the 80s, because I do agree that not only was it a concern for consumption, it was a concern for safety. So if I were to implement something like that, I would look and consider what would it cost for my insurance. You know, what does that mean for me as a restaurant owner and my liability should someone have too much to drink? Do I set up a two-drink minimum for that hour, knowing that, you know, I am now taking some responsibility of monitoring the consumption as opposed to the race for the bottom, because I'm sure there would be some in that position that would try to do that. You know, let me consume as much as I can during this 1 to 2 hour period and not even worry about eating something to try to balance that. You know, you have to consider all of the variables that you could imagine that this would cause. And yes, everything in our industry has gone up. So there would be a lot of competition in terms of creativity and, you know, who's pouring the alcohol? Are they pouring, you know, the correct amount? Are they overpouring? There's so much to this discussion that I don't think it's just a one-shot deal to
okay.
fix.
Okay, so the two of you have really helpfully laid out alongside our listeners all the yin and yang in this, the pros and cons, from people saying, you know, this is puritanical, to I don't want to be on the streets when people are drunk, to wait a minute, you want us to drop prices just as the cost of all our supplies is increasing, to you, Cheryl, saying, and then there's liability. So now I'm creating conditions where people can drink more alcohol in a short period of time. That all harkens back, and we've talked about this 1984, that all harkens back to what happened, and let's pick that up a little bit. So the state banned it in 1984 following the death of a 20-year-old woman, Kathleen Berry of Weymouth. She had been hit and dragged in a parking lot by a friend who was intoxicated after a happy hour. We were the first state to ban it. We remain only one of a handful that still have that ban. And State Senator Julian Sear proposed the amendment to the Economic Development Bill, which is now sort of dead in the water, at least for a while, to do this. So here's Julian Sear.
It empowers municipalities to determine on the local level if they'd like to offer happy hour. We've heard from cities and towns, from some small businesses, from people in our community, right, that happy hour is a tool that could help bring more people back downtown, back to Main Street, help bolster small businesses who want to offer it.
So, Philip Frateroli, you own restaurants in both Winchester and Boston. This is just saying, let cities decide. Such a bad idea to just let cities decide?
Well, I'm for you know, obviously municipalities to make up their own mind, but this was included in the economic development package. So this is the help that the Senate offers restaurants after 2 years of nothing short of hell getting through the pandemic. And it's frankly insulting because there's a lot of issues that restaurants need help with. You know, outdoor dining has been one of the few gleaming successes of the pandemic. All the executive orders that are allowing that to happen are set to expire at the end of this season. So we need help. We actually need economic development help. This isn't that. This is something to win Twitter applause with, like, young people, I guess, but it's not helping the restaurants, it's not helping operators, it's not helping society. So I just wish that they would actually take their job seriously and stop, you know, trying to be fun.
So Cheryl Strotter, turning to you, I'm going to give you a little more sound from State Senator Julian Sear, who sponsored the amendment in the Senate.
We're talking about, you know, businesses having the ability to decide whether or not they serve breakfast or do they have a late night menu. So I don't think it's so much as pits towns or municipalities sort of against one another. I think what it does is it gives a city or a town another tool to attract people to come to that town.
So focusing there, the reason I wanted to play that for you, Cheryl Strotter, so Philip has just said, hey, the pandemic has killed us as restaurant owners. We need serious relief. Sears making a different argument there, which is that actually this is for the city or town, not the restaurant. So one, your reaction to Philip saying, God, and let me backtrack, how many restaurant owners we've talked to in the last 2 years who have bemoaned a lack of sufficient economic response from the state. So pick up on that. But what if it's good for the city or town, Cheryl Strotter?
So I think that the municipalities have to decide that. This proposal pales in line with what we need to come back into a fruitful revenue stream since COVID. So I do agree that this is not the best economic plan, but what it does do is it gives restaurants in certain areas the option and the choice to institute this, and they can decide whether it's good for business. I believe that it will bring business in because people want to get out. They want to socialize. Like, being closed in for 2 years has been a challenge for every industry. So I think it would be good for business, but it has to be brought back in a way that is really at the focus of safety. I remember what happened in Weymouth. You know, I'm quite old, so I remember that, and it was terrible.
So I want to pick up on that. A couple of things. First, more from our listeners. And by the way, if you want to join our texting group, you text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. Lance of West Roxbury told us, "Yes, please, I'll go out more and promise to Uber," end quote. So to pick up, things have changed. We do have rideshare services. We have, I would argue, a different culture to some extent around drinking than we did in the early and mid-1980s. So I think about, have the times changed so that what we saw then, Philip Frateroli, is not necessarily what we can assume? And let me backtrack. Washington Post reporting, Illinois, Kansas, they reversed theirs, did not see significant upticks of drunk driving after reversing their bans. Philip.
I mean, I think it just kind of speaks to happy hour stems from this culture where the restaurant and the restaurant workers are servants of the customer. And why should restaurants be or bars be expected to discount their wares? There's a lot of thought and care that goes into menu creation and menu pricing. If we're going to talk about a change in the culture, The culture also represents the fact that restaurant owners are at a higher esteem in society than they were 40 years ago when the local tavern owner was looked down on and his wares were expected to be discounted as a trade-off for getting customers. We're in a different place now, and I think society should represent that change, that businesses, small businesses, restaurants, and bars are an important part of our society. It's an important part of our economy in Massachusetts. And we shouldn't expect something for half off or a discount just because other states are
just
doing it
or
that was the way of the past.
So Cheryl Strotter, is there a way to stop the race to the bottom? So I think, and Philip, I'm going to summarize from my perspective part of what I'm hearing you say, which is when you just can't do it, mm-hmm. then there's no temptation and there's no catalyst from one desperate restaurant owner or somebody who's got a lot of extra cash and can afford to discount to force almost like the kind of price wars you'd see, Cheryl, at gas stations across the street from each other. Is there any other way to avoid that race to the bottom, or is Philip right that it is inevitable if happy hour comes back?
I think restaurant owners have been very creative since the pandemic, not only in what they offer for food, but, you know, this upcoming conversation about alcohol. So I would approach this as perhaps having a certain discounted menu, not necessarily all of the drinks that you have on your menu. You maintain your signature drinks at that price, but then offer something. We have been creative so much at Soleil with our food menu. I'm in an office building, so you can imagine the number of people we lost as a part of our revenue stream. So we have been, you know, on that brain sink treadmill for a long time trying to figure out how to meet profit and, you know, pay our staff and stay afloat. So I think that the discounted drink menu could also be approached in the same manner. You get creative in what you offer for half price.
So I want to pivot for just a minute because I feel like you've offered a context to bring in another piece of the news of the day. So Philip, I'm mindful that, you know, the Orange Line Haymarket stop, right? You guys are talking about the unbelievable financial pressures. Cheryl, you've talked about surviving in an office building over COVID these last couple of years. Philip, starting with you, news that the Orange Line's shutting down for a month. As a restaurant owner, what does that mean to and for you?
Yeah, it's the T is an important partner for all businesses, especially in the city. And you know, we're dismayed. We also have a restaurant in East Boston, and we're facing tunnel closures on the weekends, and eventually that's going to be...
The Sumner.
Yeah, that's going to be more permanent. I mean, it just speaks to, unfortunately, that this is necessary, and there's been just underfunding of the T and of our infrastructure for too long, and it's come to roost at this point. And, you know, small businesses are going to bear that, and as a society, we have to bear it, but... I think it's important work, and I think, you know, it has to get done.
You sound kind of resigned. You kind of sound like...
It's, yeah, I mean, the political environment right now in the country, whether it comes from infrastructure or climate change or all these things, you know, it's resigning. It's kind of frustrating, and hopefully we, you know, this is a great country. We used to do great things, and I hope we can do great things again, but...
Cheryl, you chuckled when I talked about Philip's sigh.
Because I understand. I mean, that exhale is honest and it's sincere. You know, public transportation is part of the bigger picture of how this could be safer. You know, it was mentioned about the third-party apps, Lyft, and things like that. And there should be some type of campaign where, you know, there is this encouraged position to use somebody else to take you home if, in fact, that you are in a state of needing help. So that missing piece, when I heard that the Orange Line was closing down, you know, I sighed. It's like, you know, how creative can we be when there are external factors that are impacting our business that we have no control over?
Yeah. All right. And on that note, Cheryl Strotter, owner of Soleil Restaurant and Catering in Roxbury. She's also a member of the Boston Black Hospitality Coalition. And Philip Frateroli, managing partner and CEO of Philmark Hospitality Group with Jones Restaurants in both Boston and Winchester. Thanks to both of you for joining us about Happy Hour today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
You might have missed a controversial proposal that was introduced in a Boston City Council meeting in May.
Docket number 0634, Council Lara offer the following. Order for a hearing to discuss the creation of a civilian construction details program.
The creation of a civilian construction details program. That might sound like a boring 10 seconds of a city council meeting. And I don't know, maybe the meeting was slow, but the issue is lively, especially since Kendra Lara of District 6 took that question back up about who should direct traffic in and around construction sites. Should it be police officers? Should it be civilians? Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, has followed this since a Massachusetts law in 2008 made civilian flaggers legal, but certainly not common, and is here to talk this through with us. Charlie, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And no pun intended, I want to flag that we invited Boston City Councilor Kendra Lara and a representative of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Union to join us on air today. We were unable to arrange for them to join us. We also reached out to the Boston Police Department for comment, but had not heard back by showtime. So, Charlie, I want to break this down, and there's a lot going on here, but let's start. Mostly police are flaggers at road construction sites, and that was actually the law of the land before 2008, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so why did the law change in 2008?
Well, the law changed in 2008 because A, we were the only state in the union that required police, and B, we were paying multiples of what every state paid for flagging because of this requirement that it be that it be police officers who do it.
And okay, so great. Let's talk about that, because flagging duty could be lucrative for officers, according to a 2018 Pioneer report.
Right.
A police officer could, at least theoretically, earn $100,000 to $120,000 flagging,
yep.
And that is a lot more than an officer would earn for the same hours of regular work.
That correct? Is true.
And that's because in negotiations, you can set a different hourly rate for details than for regular police work.
And in addition to that, when a police does when a police officer does detail work, even if they work an hour, they get paid for 4 hours. If they work more than 4 hours, they get paid for 8 hours.
So it's 2 4-hour chunks. You either get paid for 4 hours or you get paid for 8 hours.
Right, even if you work
even
far
if
less.
You're just less in those brackets.
Yes.
Okay, so police have pushed back then on the process of the practice of hiring civilian flaggers. I want to play some old sound. This is WBUR anchor Dave Faniff back in 2008 after the law was changed to allow for civilian flaggers.
Several dozen off-duty police officers showed up at work sites today protesting the use of civilian flaggers. State officials had to move crews to the other side of a roadway in Woburn, where work cleaning catch basins was underway when the police protesters began backing up traffic. Medford Police Union Treasurer Paul Giordano says the police acted within their rights.
Under the United States Constitution, all right, we have the right to assemble and we have the right to free speech lawfully.
Has the police position in general evolved over the last 14 years, or is there continuing to be significant pushback?
Well, the police position has not evolved, but there's been no reason for the police position to evolve because we don't use civilian flaggers. Okay. So it's sort of a, you know, it's sort of a catch-22.
And I want to hit that piece of it again. We're unfolding this because amazed at how complicated this was.
Yes, it is complicated.
As we began to look at it. So first, I do want to note, one of the arguments is a public safety argument, that police officers have a level of authority, a level of experience in these kinds of environments, have training, and that civilian flaggers would not bring those same assets, especially in complicated traffic, et cetera, to the table. I want to acknowledge that argument. Yep. I also want to acknowledge that according to the city of Boston, more than 40% of requests for a police flagger in Boston went unfulfilled in 2020, which means it's not happening. People aren't filling those jobs. Okay, so with all of that in context, part of what happened here is this thing that makes no sense is just a phrase, which is prevailing wage. So lay that out,
John. All right, so let's do that. Okay, so first of all, the law does not require, I don't think anybody argues that we should use police at highly trafficked, complex sites.
No, civilians, you mean.
I'm sorry. Yeah, everybody sort of agrees that police are appropriate for those sites. The issue here is those sites, you know, that you drive by sort of in the middle of nowhere, or if you've driven outside of the country, you know, you're sort of in a rural area and you're driving and you see police there, it does not make any sense.
And again, anywhere else in the country, you would not.
That's right. So anyway, the issue here is that there's two problems with the law. One is that in those lightly traveled areas, municipalities are not required to use civilians. And I'm going to get into the prevailing wage now, which will explain why that's an issue.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was determined that these laws, that civilian flaggers, this issue comes under the state prevailing wage law.
Mm-hmm.
Massachusetts has a very unusual prevailing wage law. Most states determine prevailing wage by looking at a combination of collectively bargained contracts and what is the average wage in the area for the job. Massachusetts.
So wait, I'm going to time you out there. Yeah. They look at those two things and then say, listen, on average, what people get paid for this is X. So if you're going to have someone else do it, they also have to get paid X.
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
Massachusetts is one of only five states that ties prevailing wage exclusively to the highest collectively bargained wage in the area. And interesting, given that we're talking about public construction, and 79% of construction workers in Massachusetts choose not to join a union, yet prevailing wage is tied exclusively to the highest union rate. So what you have is a situation where it's a catch-22 because, you know, you're trying to save money by using civilians, yet the wage rate that you have to pay is tied to the wage that we pay.
So you don't really save money because you're using civilians, but you're paying them the same amount, basically, that you would pay the highest paid negotiated police officer.
Right. And as a result, we pay about twice as much for flaggers as the average of the other five New England states.
All right, so I want to flag that part again. No pun intended. I want to flag that part again because what we're talking about is an incredibly Massachusetts-y situation here, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So now you enter Boston City Councilor Kendra Lara, who has called for a hearing on this. She makes a different kind of argument, which is that people of color in the city could be getting these jobs. They are well-paying jobs at union-level rates, that people of color might be disproportionately excluded from unions, police officer ranks, et cetera, and this is a way to create new economic opportunity, not a way to save money. Reactions on that?
Well, I agree with her and I don't agree with her. I agree with her that we should create a civilian force. The civilian force should be far more diverse than the Boston Police Department. You know, not that they're not slowly becoming more diverse, but clearly it should be a workforce that represents the people in the area. Obviously, I just have profound problems with saying that we are going to pay civilian flaggers $45 an hour when, you know, the going rate in New England is $23 an hour, and asking taxpayers to pay for that.
So I do want to note that, you know, the Pioneer Institute takes positions on fiscal
sure.
issues. So you're coming from that perspective.
Absolutely.
But also one who knows how to look across this. So I want to note, we went to the Boston Human Rights Commission report from 2021, also to look at the racial breakdown of police officers, for example, in Boston, looking at Lara's argument that there can be underrepresentation. In this case, the percent of police force that is black mirrors the percentage of the city, around 22% in 2020. But that's not the case everywhere. And this representation issue, Charlie Chipio, which you acknowledged, does bring another wrinkle into this. So,
it does. It yeah. does. And I would also just be very clear about the fact that, and be honest about the fact that my focus on this issue has been a
the
statewide
savings.
Focus.
And the savings
also, yes,
issue,
but
right?
it's been a statewide focus. So I'm not expert, and I don't claim to be, on the specifics of how, you know, the workforce, what it looks like, and if it's representative in Boston.
So what we find ourselves in is a situation where you have a complex set of issues. You have a very Massachusetts-y problem.
Very Massachusetts.
We're the only ones that do it this
exactly.
way. There were only ones that pay this way. You have economic opportunity, but also economic loss,
yep.
right? And you have a legal environment that actually allows for it, but also sort of disincentivizes it because it,
yeah.
you don't really save any money.
Yeah, because look, the reality is that there are very few municipal officials who are going to weather the onslaught from police unions, you know, to save a tiny, tiny increment of money.
Yeah. So do you think this ever changes, or is this the state of things to be for the foreseeable
well,
future?
Look, yes and no. In my view, the prevailing wage law needs to change and become like the kind of prevailing wage law that other states have. That's not going to happen in Massachusetts. So I think to save money and I think to accomplish Councilor Lara's goals, you know, you have to do two things. First, you have to require that at these non-busy sites, you use civilian flaggers. The second thing is, if you're not going to change the prevailing wage law, I think you at least have to have some kind of carve out where you decouple it for flag people from the police wage.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to pivot. Last second question for you, former MBT General Manager Steve Poftek, formerly a transportation person at Pioneer.
And I worked with him in the Romney administration as well.
There you go. So this Orange Line shutdown, good idea, right way to go or not from your perspective?
No choice. I mean, not a pleasant thing, but, you know, the T is a wreck. And I don't see what choice we have at this point other than to do this.
All right. Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. I appreciate you being here in studio, too.
Thank you.
Okay, so Orange Line riders have just over 2 weeks before the entire line shuts down for a month. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey grew up in Malden using the Orange Line.
It's just unbelievable, because how can it have worked so much better when I was a boy than it works today? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. These are chronic problems that just keep repeating.
That's Ed Markey here with us on Radio Boston yesterday in response to the plans. The state says the move is needed to make the necessary repairs. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek says it's a move that will pay off for riders in years to come.
We've heard them loud and clear that they want bold action to improve the MBTA at the pace they deserve. And we know that we can't wait. So part of this shutdown is about not waiting. It is about making the necessary improvements and making them now.
And as WBUR's Simone Rios reports, T-Riders are losing patience right now after months of delays, diversions, and other problems aboard the trains.
Sung Ya Lee of Jamaica Plain uses the Orange Line every weekday to get to Logan Airport. The temporary closure announced yesterday throws a wrench into her morning routine.
So I'm just a little frustrated. I wanna know what they're gonna do about it. I know that they'll probably run the shuttle bus, but I would really want them to run it like more often, maybe like, you know, more extended hours also, because I don't want to miss my connections to other, like, you know, Blue Line or Silver Line.
The next Oak Grove train arrives in 9 minutes.
MBTA officials plan to close the Orange Line for 30 days starting August 19th. They say it's the first time in the history of the T that an entire line will be shut down that long for improvements. Governor Charlie Baker says the closure will allow the T to do the work much more quickly and avoid having to halt trains on weekends and evenings over the next 5 years.
This means that delays in Orange Line service or an unplanned shuttle diversion due to a degraded track condition will be prevented thanks to completely repaired or replaced track that will be put in place during this shutdown.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu called the Orange Line closure unprecedented and said there's not much time to plan for the diversion. But Wu said she hopes the work can make the line safer and avoid even more delays in the future.
I'm hopeful that doing this work thoroughly, doing it in one stretch, and getting it done now will mean that we are saving years of disruptions in the long run.
But many people riding the T yesterday were frustrated. Leslie Good of Jamaica Plain commutes to North Station on the Orange Line. She questions why the T work didn't happen early in the pandemic.
This subway sat empty for a year and a half during COVID. Perfect time for that, this to have happened. There was no one on the road. There was no one on the T. I think this is the perfect example of government is not here to fix our problems.
Good lives right across the street from the Orange Line and will see the impact every day. But she says the closure will be even worse for people who have to take a bus to the Orange Line and already face a longer commute. And she doesn't have much hope the delays will end anytime soon, not with the same people in charge of the T.
Only if we got some fresh blood in here. That would be my recommendation. And I don't mean some guy from Everett. I mean some guy from Queens or some guy from Seoul.
State transit leaders say they understand the frustration. Now they're making a bold bet that a month-long shutdown will avoid years of frustration in the future.
That's WBUR's Simone Rios. Oh, I could listen to that all day. Ever haunting sound of humpback whales. And if you've ever gone whale watching off the Massachusetts coast, you've probably heard that in a special place called Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. Stellwagen Bank, sort of an ocean equivalent to Acadia National Park, but out in the Atlantic, not far from here. And this time of the year, the sanctuary is teeming with whales. And a lot more. Joining us in studio, underwater photographer Keith Ellenbogen, who has spent years swimming and capturing much of the wildlife in the sanctuary, and now has an exhibit that's on display outside the New England Aquarium as we observe the 30th anniversary of Stellwagen Bank. Keith, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
I am so excited to talk to you about these photographs. I mean, they're incredible. And listen, we're just going to dive right in because this, like, no pun intended, I'm full of these accidental puns today. You have your laptop here and we are looking at this picture that you took. Okay, so we've got the water on the surface. It is almost like a cerulean maybe or an aqua blue underneath. You can almost see nothing, but right above it, above the surface, we see the full tail of a whale. So it doesn't exist below the surface, and it does above. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's the challenge of underwater photography in New England. We have this beautiful, it's really described as an emerald green color that is filled with nutrient-rich planktonic life. And it's so dense and thick that when I was close to a whale swimming, and I should just note to everyone, I have a marine mammal photography permit that allows me the unique access to go in the water and dive with whales. And I'm about 15 feet from a whale that's descending underwater. But what's odd about the picture and what's odd is that you can't see the body underwater.
It's a whale and you can't see the body.
50 feet long or tall and 15 feet away and you don't even see a glimpse or a shadow. And that's the challenge of my photography under there, is that you have to be close to these animals to capture these dramatic images. But the life is extraordinary in Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. And it's animals like this, the humpback whale, as well as many others that are here.
Now, you, how did you get started doing this?
You know, I always loved the marine life. And when I was 16, I started diving off the coast of New England up in Gloucester. I actually volunteered at the New England Aquarium. And then that same year, my grandfather, who was an amateur photographer, gave me my first underwater camera, a Nikonis 5. And I just started diving and taking pictures because I loved it. And I've never stopped.
And are there things that you can encounter, that you can see at Stellwagen Bank, that you just don't elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's remarkable is a very predictable place to see humpback whales. And most people say, like, well, where do you go watch whales? And they would think naturally like Alaska, or they go to other parts of the world. But Boston has them. And in addition to humpback whales, you could see dolphin. You can see mola mola from the surface.
What's a mola mola?
A mola mola is the world's largest bony fish. And sometimes you see its fin just above the surface. And you're like, well, what is that? And it's like a 1,000-pound fish. It's huge. Round and very sort of looks always a little...
Do you have a picture of a mola mola here?
I do have a picture of a mola mola. Let me see if I can find one for you here really quickly.
So keep talking about
it. So the mola mola is, it's sort of, when you see it, it has this clumsy side to it, which is what people's impression is it's just sunning itself. Sometimes it's called an ocean sunfish. But when I've been underwater with it, what's amazing is they take on a whole new persona. And they swim in this really balletic movement of which their dorsal fin and their bottom fin just sort of move, and they become fast and graceful and really beautiful to watch. And they're very curious, and makes it an amazing fish to encounter. And the thing that I love most is that people travel all over the world, in the Galapagos and other places, to go see mola mola. But they're also here, right off our coast. And here, let me just pull this picture up for you as we're doing.
And we're talking really right off our coast, about 20 miles.
Right off our coast, 20 miles away, so not very far. But one of the challenges of marine wildlife is, unlike a national park like you were talking about earlier, in order to get there, you have to take a boat to it, or you have to swim underwater. And so photography is an excellent vehicle to be able to bring people into the underwater world.
Where they can't be on their own. I'm looking at this picture of the mola mola, which I think is in the exhibit.
Yeah. It is in the exhibit.
And it looks to me like if a second grader drew a picture of an upside-down, overweight dolphin with an orange nose... This is what you would see. I've never seen, I mean, I guess I was picturing like a big grouper or something. I've never seen anything like this.
I mean, that's what's wonderful about the ocean environment. It's all these unusual animals with exotic shapes and sizes and swimming styles. And, you know, you as an artist, as a creative person, it's always, you know, it's an example of like imagination of how you can create different types of fish all the time. And it's a wonderful experience to explore and discover and to see these animals.
Okay, we're going to bring one more voice in here in a second. But first, I want to talk about large marge.
So one of the other extraordinary animals that comes through here are basking sharks. Basking sharks, for those that don't know, are the world's second largest shark. And they feed on the planktonic animals within our nutrient-rich waters.
So non-scary sharks.
Non-scary sharks, beautiful, peaceful, and they come right here and off the coast. Well, on this one day, I was out with the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary team. And we were looking, and it was one of those dreamy kind of days that you have where the sea is totally flat, no wind, and you can see miles away. And we see a fin break on the surface. And we're all like... swimming very slow, and we're all like, oh, this is a basking shark. And so we position the boat in such a way that I can go snorkeling in. So I'm wearing a wetsuit, a mask, a snorkel, so I'm just free diving. And I'm using a 360-degree camera, a camera that can shoot in multiple directions all at once. And I start swimming in the water, snorkeling, and I follow to the fin. And all of a sudden, now again, the visibility underwater is only about 20 feet at best. And so as I'm swimming in, I'm about to encounter this basking shark. I'm ready to dive under and see this with a big mouth open. And I notice a pointy snout, a white underbelly.
Oh.
And I realize that this is no longer a beautiful basking shark, but a 17-foot, 3,000-pound great white shark.
Oh, my God.
I was so close to this thing, I could have touched it. You and I were, I was literally less than a foot away. And the shark just continued to swim. And for 11 seconds of glorious footage, I was able to hold the camera steady. I did the only thing I've ever known how to do, which is just brace for a shot.
Sit still.
Sit still and let life just pass on. And I could see each tooth. I could see its eyes stare at me. And it's unmistakable. I mean, it has a big eye that just like is very interactive. And I think the thing that's really just so amazing is it shows that we have these apex predators, and they're big predators, but they're not just man-eaters that just want to snap and kill at everything, but they are a symbol of a healthy ocean ecosystem. I could safely say I would never dive with one again. It's in a huge animal. It was, when I was as close to it, it made the ocean disappear. It was so big. And to give people a sense of the size of it, a 17-foot, 3,000-pound white shark was bigger than the small boat that I was on that I launched into.
Oh my God.
To go photograph it.
Okay, you're capturing the beauty, and thank you, but you're also terrifying me. So listen, we have Keith Ellenbogen here, who's an underwater photographer, is also a visiting artist at MIT, while we talk about the Stellwagen Bank Natural Marine Sanctuary. And I'm going to bring in another voice here. This is Pete DiCola, who's the superintendent of the Stellwagen Bank Natural Marine Sanctuary. Pete's on the line from NOAA. Pete, welcome. Thank you.
Good morning, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
So I just want to hear your reaction as a steward here of what you're hearing from Keith.
Well, it's mostly jealousy because he has the best job in the world. I've been part of those missions where we toss Keith in the water and he gets to get up close and personal with the living marine animals in Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. And he does such a great job of capturing the essence of their being and then allowing us to display it at the New England Aquarium on the public walkway surrounding the aquarium. So we're just really thrilled to be working with Keith and MITC Grant and the New England Aquarium, great education partners in this endeavor.
So you are with the National Oceanic Atmosphere and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and this is a 30-year-old National Marine Sanctuary stewarded by NOAA. Tell us about that. What does it mean to be a National Marine Sanctuary, and how did it come to be?
Okay, so the National Marine Sanctuary, we're part of the National Marine Sanctuary system, which turns 50 years old this year as well. And that is a system of 15 sanctuaries protecting over 620,000 square nautical miles of ocean and Great Lakes territory. The National Marine Sanctuaries Act was passed 50 years ago along with a whole host of other environmental legislation, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species, Marine Mammal Protection, Coastal Zone Management, Fisheries Management. That whole series of legislation. And then 20 years later, in 1992, Congress designated Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. And really, our missions are to protect the ecological integrity and cultural legacy of the sanctuary. We have 47 shipwrecks in our sanctuary that date from a couple hundred years to more recent times. We're also charged with enhancing public awareness in the marine environment, which is why we have a great exhibit out in front of the aquarium. We're also charged with promoting responsible recreation and tourism along with sustainable uses of the ocean resources. So it's a bit of a balancing act we have to do. And it's not easy, but it's worthwhile because if you're out in Stellwagen Bank, you know that the juice is worth the squeeze there.
And is it working back to Keith Ellenbogen, who is an underwater photographer, has a special license to be diving and photographing there? 30 years, is it working? Do you think you'd have a different environment to photograph in if we had not created this sanctuary?
I think it's working. I think it's working for sure. Can it be better? Probably. But what I will say is the act put in substantial protections 30 years ago. One was the prohibition of oil and gas exploration in a very important feeding area for humpback whales and other sei whales, minke whales, dolphins, a whole host of marine animals. And that also applies to wind energy development, which is ongoing now in the Gulf of Maine and starting the planning process for that. And we're involved in that as well. It also prohibited sand gravel mining, which is actually probably one of the reasons the sanctuary came into existence was because there was initially a plan to mine the sand to support the big dig construction.
Yep.
It would have been much cheaper to barge that sand in. But what we found through our robust science programs is that that would have been a tremendous mistake because removing that sand habitat would have removed extremely productive habitat grounds where fish like the sand lance thrive, and that's what the humpback whales feed on. Whenever you see a humpback whale breaching, you'll see a cloud of fish surrounding it, and those fish are normally sand lance. They could also be herring or menhaden, but mostly sand lance.
That's Pete DeCola, who is the superintendent of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, which is having its 30-year anniversary. To Pete, we're going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. Still with us, Keith Ellenbogen, who's an underwater photographer and has benefited from this preservation for 30 years of the Stellwagen Bank Observatory. Excuse me. Observatory is a different thing. Marine.
Sanctuary.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Pete. So, Keith, tell us about another one of your favorite photos.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's remarkable is it's other encounters that are out there. I think that our people sometimes skip over are these beautiful schools and giant schools of mackerel. And sometimes people refer to them as bait fish or just fish that they catch. And it seems so unfortunate to me because they're this beautiful bluish kind of color with like green, different hues, and they swim in large numbers. And one day, most of the time they stay just beyond the barrier, but one day they swim in a whole school right in sort of clearish water near me. And I remember this as a really remarkable moment. And if they just are... from a photographic point of view, really beautiful to see and photograph. But I can share some another animal that really is unusual. As I was down on a shipwreck, the Patriot, and we encountered a large torpedo ray. And I don't know if you know what a torpedo ray is.
No, I mean, I can imagine what a torpedo looks like, and I can imagine a stingray.
Well, a torpedo ray is more like a giant disc of an animal.
Right. I'm looking at your picture. It does. It looks like a sign of a flat, grayish, bluish, blackish disc sitting right on the ground.
Yeah. It just lays there perfectly camouflaged and sort of stays still. And it's fairly large. I would say it was about 4 feet round in sort of diameter or 5 feet. But they have a remarkable ability. And their ability is that when a small fish swims above it, it can emit electricity. And actually can shock the fish.
Of course it can.
Of course. I mean, why not have
right,
another?
Why not?
But if you're going to have a superpower, you might as well be able to emit electricity or something along those kind of ways. And so it's just another example of nature just having an ingenious solution to solving a way to catch and to be a predator. And, you know, but it's a big ocean out there. So how do you find these things? And the thing is that one of the challenges is that time in the water is the ability to be able to see and photograph them. But I will say that Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary is teeming with extraordinary marine life. It just takes time to get under there, explore, and discover what is really amazing just off our coast in New England.
All right. Keith Ellenbogen is an underwater photographer and a visiting artist at MIT and my new candidate for a segment on Radio Boston called Storytime with Keith. I think after this, Keith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana. It was wonderful to be here.
It's great to have you.